Hey guys, and welcome to Hunting Land, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. If you'd like to stay up to date on hunting tactics, land management, land values, and land market dynamics, this is the podcast for you. This week's show is brought to you by First South Farm Credit. What does a farm mean to you? Maybe it's just a piece of land where you can go relax or enjoy the outdoors. Whatever the farm means to you, First South Farm Credit can help you finance or refinance that perfect piece of land. As a successful financial cooperative, First South shares its profits with its borrowers in the form of a patronage refund, which lowers your cost of borrowing. To find out how First South can help you, visit their website at firstsouthland.com or call them at 800-955-1722. They are an equal housing lender.
All right, folks, welcome back to Hunting Land. I appreciate you joining me this week. I am your host, Butch Theory, and I have Nick Williams, the managing editor of Great Days Outdoors Magazine and host of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, joining me today. Looking forward to our topic today, Nick. We're going to talk to Chuck Sykes about how to determine if your deer needs supplemental feeding. I feel like this is a topic that gets thrown around a lot by landowners. I'm definitely guilty of it. We plant what we think the deer need and just not really sure a lot of the times.
Yeah, I'm excited to be sitting in on it. I do mostly public land, so I don't have a lot of direct experience with supplemental feeding, but I do, for whatever reason, I really enjoy reading the stuff that Auburn University puts out and the Mississippi State puts out. I find it interesting, herd management, land management, so it should be a good conversation.
Yep, definitely excited to get into it, man. And to do that today, we're going to be talking with Chuck Sykes. He is the Director of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries in the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Welcome to Hunting Land, Mr. Sykes. How are we doing today?
I'm good. Thank you all for having me.
Good, good. Thank you for joining us. It's always good to hear from you. Just tell us a little bit about your background and your journey to becoming the director.
Wrong place at the wrong time. I graduated from Auburn in 92 with a degree in wildlife, worked for several consultants early on, ran a commercial hunting operation outside of Auburn for about 8 years. And while I was doing that, I was growing some pretty good deer and doing some things that folks hadn't been doing. I mean, y'all got to think that was a long time ago. Food plots weren't a big deal on the scene. And I had quite a bit of press come out and everything from progressive farmer to outdoor life. And by taking a few outdoor riders hunting, my name kind of got out, so I started a consulting business and ended up doing fairly well with that, managing properties all over the country, and then created the Management Advantage television show that was the first that was about management. It wasn't about just killing something, it was about producing something. And then from there, I actually had a couple of my consulting clients ask me to apply for this job when it came open. And I had no desire to take it, didn't want to go work for the state. And my ex-wife actually filled out my application for me. And when I got a call to come interview, I was working a job in Illinois. And long story short, after a couple of weeks, I was back in Alabama and interviewed. And the commissioner asked me why I wanted this job. And I told him I didn't. And he said, well, why are you here? So, well, some people thought I would be good at it, and it's what Alabama needed right now. And the harder I tried to convince him that I wasn't a guy for the job, the more he was determined that I was. And I won't ever be able to thank him enough for seeing in me something that I didn't see. I mean, I was self-employed basically my whole career. I had one employee, and when I started here, it was about 350 employees and trying to learn the state system and the bureaucracy and the politics. And he saw something in me that I didn't. And today, as I'm talking to y'all, I'm the second longest tenured director in the country.
That's really cool.
The average tenure for my position is a little less than 3 years. And December will be 12 for me. So very fortunate that I've had a supportive administration and some really good staff. And my main job is to get out of the way and let them do theirs and just keep things rolling.
That's very cool. You got to have a good chief up there for sure. We definitely appreciate everything that you do for our wildlife and for our hunters and people that enjoy the outdoors. It's funny how, hearing that story, it's just funny how, you never know who's going to make such an impact on on your life, you know?
Yep, you never know, and the Lord has things that He wants you to do, and it's not on your schedule, and you just got to be open to when the door opens, you got to be ready to go through there and try to accept the next challenge.
That's right. Sounds like the director role chose you. You didn't choose it.
It pretty much did, and again, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have done it.
Very cool. Well, again, thank you for joining us today. Today, we're going to be talking about supplemental feeding, kind of how to determine if your deer needs supplemental feeding. I'm kind of going through this right now in my place on Dallas County. We got a lot of soybeans in the ground. We have some mixes, just trying to get those antlers as big as they possibly can and give the deer the nutrition they need to, do their fawn gestation well and grow those big horns as big as they can. When I think supplemental feeding, I think about troughs, food plots, minerals. Is that all considered supplemental feeding, or what is the definition?
It depends on who you ask. I mean, it can be a variety of things. To me, supplemental feeding needs to be exactly what the name says. It is something in addition. It's not what is required. It's not what those animals need to live and survive. This is something that is added or a supplement just to help even out the highs and lows. I mean, and I'm going to be pulling a lot of this. This is back from long days ago when I was on a tractor 60 hours a week and working in the woods and constantly managing property. Habitat is the first thing that I wanted to focus on. And if the habitat is good, the deer are going to eat the native foods before they eat anything else. What I use supplemental feeding for on my clients' properties and now on my own place is when times are tough, it's dry, it's hot, the native vegetation has lost a lot of its nutrients. I want to have something there for them where the lows aren't so low. And the deer that are not at the top of the pecking order still have a little nutrition there.
What exactly do you mean by the highs and the lows, and how do we know that?
All right, and I'll give you just a great example from back in my previous life when I was managing a piece of property outside of Auburn. It's 5,000 acres, heavy pine timber that was managed extremely well. Did have food plots, but the majority of the habitat was thinned, burned on rotation. It was really good. So that again, now this you're talking about mid to late 90s. So let's just say 96, 97, back before all the food plot craze and all of this came about. I put out a half a dozen trough style feeders with soybeans in them. The deer would eat a handful a week out of it. And if I didn't get rain for 2 weeks, they would eat two or three handfuls a week. If I didn't get rain for another week, they would start eating a little bit more. Then as soon as I got a half inch of rain, it stopped. They quit using the feeders because they went back to the native vegetation. So what I'm saying is knocking the lows out. When it gets hot and dry, the plants are stressed, the nutritional value is not what it needs to be. Having a supplemental feed there where the lows are not so low is what I use it for. Now, I know there are some people that live and die by it. They love a trough. They love a feeder. To me, you're asking me personally, that's not what supplemental feeding is there for. It is there just to fill in a gap when Mother Nature has some obstacles like heat and drought and things like that, or in February before things put out. Between February and end of February and April, when the spring green up comes in and all the acorns are gone and there's not a whole lot in the woods, when those bucks are dropping antlers, giving them a supplemental food source there to help them get started off on the right foot. That's when I'm looking at using supplemental feed, is at the end of winter to spring green up, and then July, August, and September, those last 3 months when does are dropping. Bucks are finishing out, and that's when the conditions are as lean as they're going to be in our part of the world. That's when I think a supplemental feeding program can help.
Just give them a little boost to get what they need.
Yep.
That definitely makes sense.
Yeah, I really everything that you're talked about, I kind of like the viewpoint that you take towards it, because I know I've talked with a lot of people in the past, and I've witnessed, what gets called supplemental feeding, and you kind of raise your eyebrows because there'll be a trough for a feeder, and then there's a camera on it, and then 100 yards away there's a shooting house, and it's like, well, that just kind of seems like a lighter term for what looks like baiting to me from the outside looking in. So what you're saying is, in a perfect world, you wouldn't supplemental feed, like the habitat would carry the herd.
Absolutely. If you're doing your habitat management correctly, that should suffice, except for those small periods of time, like I'm talking about late winter, early spring, and late summer, early fall, when things are tough. And supplemental feed is not corn. Supplemental feed is a nutritional food that's going to have protein to the level that they need, not just candy.
Yep, definitely makes sense. Like I mentioned there in the intro, we are kind of going through this on our place. We got some soybeans in the ground, and we were talking, we got soybeans, we got mixes, and Dad was saying, do we need to be feeding soybean pellets as well? Can we give them too much? Should we give them too much? We burned this spring a bunch, and we got some cameras on our beans to kind of regulate, see what's eating what and how they're doing as far as the growing season and things like that. And we just have not seen, I mean, they're in there. But I just assumed that whenever it came up and started shooting up, that they would just absolutely smash it.
How many years have you planted? Is this the first year?
Well, we did 3 years ago, and we skipped last year, and then we did this year. So,
A lot of times that first year, they'll lull you into complacency and they'll let it get up before they get on it. And then next year you plant it in the same place at the same time, it'll end up looking like a bunch of toothpicks out there. You'll need to fence it off.
interesting.
Another example is our place is over in Choctaw County. We've got roughly 1,000 acres on the Tombigbee River that's pretty much split half and half. About 450 of it is bottomland hardwoods, mature canopy closure. You can see forever under it. I popped three clear cuts in it about 5 years ago, a 40, a 20, and a 15-acre clear cut. That 2 years after we cut it, I got a skidder operator to come in and spray Arsenal in there, selective imazapyr herbicide, because I don't want trees back in it. I want to maintain that early succession. Deer are stacked in there right now because outside of that area, you can see forever, there's not a whole lot of food. Right across the creek is predominantly pines that we did a first thin 2 summers ago. We burned it last year. So those deer on that side of the creek have got more food than they've seen in a decade. I've got three protein feeders on the west side of the creek in the pine stand, and I've got three on the east side of the creek in the hardwoods. The pine stands, over the past month, they've eaten about 100 pounds. Over on the hardwood side, they're eating 1,000 pounds a week.
Wow.
It's just the abundance of the food is not there, and the quality is not there in that big bottomland hardwood site, except in those clear cuts. And I just don't have enough clear cuts to completely keep them full like the pine stand. And you wouldn't think a creek that's 20 yards wide would be that big of a barrier, but those deer have their own little home ranges, and some of them will cross back and forth, but it's just not the case. They typically stay on their side of the creek, and I've been watching that for the past month on the food consumption there.
Yep, I definitely agree with that.
Chuck, I wanted to circle back to something that you were saying earlier. So I've observed kind of firsthand what you're talking about with deer being more hard up for nutrition in the late summer and in the late winter. And you can kind of see it, at least where I'm at, with roadkill and with like daylight deer activity on the side of the road. Like I noticed, obviously you get that kind of bump during the rut when deer are out on their feet more. You'll see a buck chasing does across the field or something. But just here on the I-10 corridor in between Montgomery and Mobile, you always see after hunting season, you see a bunch of roadkill deer. And then late summer, I've noticed that about the time that I'm getting ready for teal season, like it seems like the browse has kind of dried up, gone woody, died off, but then the oaks haven't quite come in yet. And usually about the time I start scouting for this year's hot oak trees is when I start noticing on my daily drive, okay, there's no more deer on the side of the interstate. They're all off in the woods eating acorns.
That's right.
And What you were talking about, having piney woods and having hardwoods, kind of talk to me a little bit about how, like, if you have a piece of property, okay, well, I've got mature oaks here, that's going to produce a corn crop in the fall. And then I've got this territory over here that's going to produce browse. What do you do without, I guess, kind of resorting to a feed trough and supplemental feeding? What can you do to make sure that you're giving them food during that late summer period and during that late winter period? And is it the same strategy during both time periods, or do different things work for different times of the year?
Again, I'm going to go back. I know we're wanting to talk about supplemental feed, but habitat management trumps supplemental feed any day. They had rather have what Mother Nature gives them. So, with us burning and thinning and knocking our numbers down a little bit, those deer are as fat and happy right now as they can be. And then you jump over to those hardwoods. And it's beautiful. You get a warm, fuzzy feeling when you go in there. I love hunting them during bow season when those chestnut oaks are dropping. It's my favorite place to be. But 9 months out of the year, there's nothing for them to eat in there. It's boom or bust. They've either got so many acorns you can't corral them, or it's nothing there. So trying to offset that, I cut as much as my family would let me cut. And made those bigger block clear cuts that's feeding 10 times the amount of deer that it would if the whole place was still open. So I'm trying to do as much of that as I can, but then I do have, again, I started about the end of May with changing and putting my trough feeders. We got hogs everywhere. So I've got little corrals built around my feeding stations to keep the hogs out. And before turkey season came in, I let all my spin feeders dry up. And then the end of May, I went in, took my spin feeders out, put my troughs in, and started feeding. And I've tried just about everything over the years, and everybody's got their favorite concoction. But what I'm feeding now, it's easy. It doesn't mold, it doesn't mildew with all of our humidity. I'm just running a roasted soybean corn mixture. And it's pretty hot. I mean, it so they only eat as much as they need, and then they go browse. They just don't stand there and eat and eat and eat and eat and eat. But just a general rule of thumb, if you put out a whether it's a pellet or a mixture of corn and beans or whatever, 16% protein. If you can just keep that as your base, if you can get them 16%, that's what they need to do what they need to do. And it's real important this time of year when the does are dropping and lactating, those bucks are finishing off. And then I think it's just as important in late February, March, and early April before turkey season gets really kicking. Those bucks need it to, they're coming out of the rut. They're run down, food scarce, and it really gets them started good. And if you can get a good start and then waiting on that spring greening up, it really gives them a jump where they're in good shape coming into the end of the summer when things get tight again.
Yes, sir. And I think you just answered this question, and you kind of hit on it with the highs and the lows, but I just want to clarify, the need for human intervention with the supplemental feeding. You just are trying to give them a little boost whenever they can't get or won't get what they need in the natural environment, correct?
Yeah, it is supplemental food. It is not their main food source. I don't want them dependent on a trough or a feeder. That's not natural. It's not good for them on many levels. But if you can get your habitat right, that will sustain your deer herd, and then minimal supplemental feeding will help keep them on a level plane throughout the season.
Understood. That definitely makes sense. Going back to my situation, talking about the soybean fields, I think we have about 10 acres planted. Dad was asking if we need to put out more. We've done the roasted soybean pellets with the corn, and it goes over really well. They love it. But how do you know if you're providing enough nutrients for your herd, and what are the signs that you are or aren't?
You've got to get some baseline data. And most people don't want to do this, But every deer we kill, we're on the Deer Management Assistance Program that our department has. I take weights, ages, lactation rates, and measurements on our bucks. You got to have a starting point, or you don't know if you're making progress or not. And you can watch those weights. There's no substitute for your trail cameras and personal observations, just looking at the overall health of your deer, but actually getting some concrete data, whether your 3.5-year-old bucks are averaging 188 or 178, that's a big difference. And if you're up in the 180s for 3 or 4 years and then you drop down into 170s, you might want to look. You either got too many deer or not enough feed. I would prefer knocking my numbers down and working on my habitat rather than pouring it out of a bag. It gets expensive. It's just not natural.
It definitely makes sense.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. So when you're talking about all this, when you're talking about kind of getting baseline data and then working with a DMAP, Deer Management Assistance Programs, taking the data, doing the supplemental feeding and then tracking it to see if it makes a difference. What's kind of the cutoff point when it comes to the acreage that you need to effectively do this? 'Cause I know there's a lot of guys who are, maybe hunting meemaws 20 acres up in the country, and then there's guys that got big tracts of land, like you talked earlier about managing a large tract before you work with the state. Is it something where you need 50 acres, 500 acres, 5,000 acres? Like, at what level does it start making a difference?
You just have to have realistic expectations. If you've got 100 acres, you can do all you can do, but you're relying on your neighbors. Even on the 1,000 acres that I manage right now, I have real good relationships with my neighbors.
Big
And I'm
difference.
sharing pictures. They're sharing pictures. And I mean, we'll even cut deals with each other. This buck, I know he's big, he's trading back and forth. I won't shoot him if you won't shoot him. You're never going to keep them all on your place. I don't care how big a place you've got. So, working with your neighbors to make a co-op where you're pretty much on the same page helps a lot. But I mean, even if you've got 40 acres, all you can do is make your 40 acres the best you can and then hope for the best, understanding that you're not going to be able to keep deer on your place. I mean, the home range is roughly a square mile, that's 640 acres. You just have to have realistic expectations.
Yep.
So I don't think there is a thing that's too small or too big. Just know your limitations and don't expect too much. I mean, even on places in the Midwest that I've managed, it's got topsoil 6 feet deep, great genetics, everything's good. There's not 140 inch deer behind every tree.
Sure.
And I think trail cameras and TV shows and YouTube videos, they're giving a lot of folks unrealistic expectations about what they can expect to do.
I absolutely agree with that. Just looking at it exactly the way you just said, I'm super guilty of it. Just like I'm super proud of all the beans we planted. They're doing well, and we've done it in previous years. And like, oh man, those deer just why aren't their horns big enough this year? Why aren't their horns big enough this year? But I really like what you just said about it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be a historical data. Get your baseline, and you really got to track this for years and years, and kind of taper your plan accordingly.
It's adaptive management. I mean, you get a storm come through, knocks down a bunch of trees, you get a massive drought.
Well, like last year, we didn't have any acorns.
I had one chestnut that dropped acorns. It was pretty much a bust except for a few water oaks. So our deer were they were down a little bit on body size last year. They couldn't bulk up like they normally do, but I try not to look. Of course, we all want to kill a deer likes 170 inch deer, everybody wants to. But over the years, I tried to get my clients, and now on our place, we shoot for age, period. I don't care what he looks like. If you can kill a 5-year-old deer, that's a trophy. And on our place, even though I know we're going to lose some to natural causes, we're going to lose some to neighbors, we're going to lose some to poachers up and down the river. It's going to happen. We do not shoot a deer, maybe a 4-year-old, but typically all our deer are 5 or 6 years old before we shoot them. And last year we killed 2 5-year-olds and a 6-year-old. It doesn't matter what they scored. Those were mature deer. I mean, the deer that I hunted all year and I killed him and wrote an article about it in the magazine, he was 5 1/2 and was a 5 point. And he was a stud. And
Yes,
I,
sir.
one of my favorite deer that I've ever killed in Alabama, killed him with my bow, had pictures of him since he was 3. He was an 8 point as a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old, and we passed him up. And at December, or well, I guess it was mid-January when he was 4, he busted his left knee up really bad, and I didn't even know if he was going to make it through the year. And we debated on whether to try to shoot him because he was a big deer, but we said no, we're going to give him a chance to go. And he came back this year as a bow-legged, knock knee, just huge, looked like he had a softball in his knee, 5 point. And I was tickled to death to kill him with my bow this year. So realistic expectations, I know I'm going to lose some. Biggest deer that I grew a couple of years ago, I had him at 15 yards for 30 minutes with my bow. He was a 4-year-old that scored like 135. And I did not touch my bow. Neighbor
Very
killed him.
fine.
I can't fault them. It's a 135-inch deer
Right.
in Alabama, in Choctaw County, where those don't grow on trees. But if he had been 5, he'd have probably been 150. But you
Right.
can't fault anybody for doing that. So again, I have realistic expectations. Yeah,
Yes,
I
sir.
could have killed that deer, and it would have been the biggest deer I'd ever killed in Alabama with a bow.
Couldn't do it.
Couldn't do it.
I had one of those
Hoped he
this
was
year as
gonna
well.
make it through. Hoped he was gonna make it through, and he didn't. But
Yes.
then, we've passed up these deer that we kill this year as 4 and 5-year-olds, and kill one at 6 and two at 5. So it happens.
Yep, it definitely does. And not to get us off topic here, I know we're talking about supplemental feeding, but I mean, it's everywhere, social media. How old is this deer? Should I have killed him? Should I have let him walk? I mean, what are some of the telltale signs that you look for in a 4 1/2 and a 5-year-old deer?
Again, there's no substitute for personal experience on your own property. That's what I had to tell my clients, and still today, people send me pictures. You know your deer better than I do. I know my deer on my property a lot better than y'all will. I can send y'all pictures of deer that y'all will say 3 or 4. Well, I've got pictures of him for the past 3 years, so I know he's 6. So running cameras for me, we do a lot of entertaining. I have a lot of people that are not very experienced coming in. Some of my counterparts from other parts of the state, I mean, other parts of the country that are not big whitetail hunters. I can't expect them to know what a 4-year-old deer looks like.
Especially in Alabama, it's different.
It's different. Yeah. I mean, a 140-pound deer down here would be 1.5 years up in their part of the world, and it might be 4 down here. So I put together a shoot, don't shoot list with pictures of the deer. Some of them I've got pictures when he was 2, 3, and 4 years old. And I make a book and I give it to them because I don't want them to make a mistake. And I don't want a deer that we've invested 2 years in getting mistakenly shot by one of my people. But keys to look at on ages, if you don't have the history on the deer and the pictures and all that to go by. A good rule of thumb, if you think he's not big enough, he's not. That's period. If there is one doubt in your mind, don't shoot him because you're going to be disappointed. If you see a deer and you think, oh my goodness, I've got to kill him, be happy no matter what he looks like. But picture a deer standing broadside to you. And if you take a 2x4 and stick it right behind his front shoulders and just imagine you put it there and you pick him up off the ground. If he tips forward, he's old enough to shoot. If he tips backwards, he's not old enough to shoot. The older a deer gets, the bigger in the chest they get, the bigger their neck gets, the bigger their front end gets. And once they get 6 or 7, they start losing muscle tone in the back end. So they look more like a buffalo. They're real heavy in the front end, light in the back. A younger deer is not going to be that way. They're going to be streamlined. They're going to be bigger in the back end than the front. So that, to me, that's as easy a way to tell. But, and again, I've been writing articles for the magazine for a decade now, And I did one just on this topic. And I took three people from my office and stood them side by side and took a picture of them to put them in the magazine. You didn't have to know that one of them was 65, one of them was 35, and one of them was 20. You knew which one was the youngest, which one was the middle, and which one was mature. Deer are the same way. If you look at them, you can tell. You might not know that deer's two or three, but you know he's not old enough to shoot. You might not know he's five or six, but he's a big bull, blocky thing. You know he's old enough to shoot.
I like where you're saying where if they're big enough, you'll know, because I agonized the first year I got drawn for an SOA hunt up there in Dallas County. Man, I looked at pictures and agonized and took a tape to all the deer on my wall. I'm like, all right, it's got to be, I think it was a 16-inch main beam and 18-inch main beam, 16-inch inside spread. And like, I was committed, like, man, I do not want to mess this up, and agonized over it. And then the deer that I ended up shooting, I saw him coming through the woods 200 yards away. And before I ever saw antlers, I was just like, yeah, that's a shooter.
There he
Like,
is.
that's a big barrel chested bruiser, like shuffling his feet, dragging through, just kind of lumbering. Like, that's a shooter.
And you are 100% right on that. I don't have the most experience in the world, but I can definitely say that when you know, you know. And if you go, you do the binoculars thing, the scope thing, don't shoot him because you're going to be disappointed
If
every
you
time.
talk yourself into shooting him, he
Disappointed.
ain't big enough.
I saw several deer like that before because the property had a bunch of deer. So you were getting to see more deer than I've ever seen before. I saw a bunch of them on the scouting days. And I had a few, like you were saying, Butch. I was glassing them and trying to make them grow a couple inches,
Never
and
works.
literally, I don't think I looked at the antlers on this deer when I pulled the trigger on him. Like, you could just tell looking at him, you're like, dude, that's a huge deer. That deer's got, 50, 60 pounds on every deer I've seen this weekend.
And it
Especially,
doesn't matter what he scores at that point. That is a mature deer that most people never have an opportunity to see, much less take.
And the other deer's behavior too. Whenever the man comes out, the other deer just act totally different. The deer I killed this past season, well, I had him on camera a couple times, and I wasn't quite sure how big his antlers actually were. But whenever he came out and all the other deer literally lost their mind and freaked out, you could just tell that he was the man lumbering down that shooting lane. And I was like, yep, there he is. There was no doubt about it. I didn't even pick up my binoculars. I definitely agree with that.
All right, folks, we're going to be right back. Y'all take a minute and check out some of our sponsors. If you're looking for a beautiful state that's packed with outdoor attractions, check out Mississippi. Of course, you know about the Mississippi River, but there are a lot of great rivers for paddling throughout the state. Coastal Mississippi's waters are perfect for deep sea fishing or exploring the state's five uninhabited barrier islands. You'll find national forests with campgrounds, trails, and recreational sites, 25 state parks, and wildlife management areas too. Whatever you like to do in the great outdoors, you can do in Mississippi, where wanderers are welcome. Plan your adventure at visitmississippi.org/outdoors.
Chuck, I wanted to circle back to something that you had mentioned earlier. So you said you had a lot of hogs on your property, and I know all up and down the Alabama and the Tom Bigbee River, you're gonna have hogs, and if you don't have them this year, you just wait, you'll have them next year. What do you do if you are putting out supplemental feed? What can you do to make sure that you're not causing problems? Because I know, like, as a homeowner, you fertilize your lawn, and unfortunately, you also fertilize your weeds. So how do you make sure that you don't dig yourself into a hole with supplemental feeding?
During again, we do a lot of entertaining. I take a lot of first time folks. I have some feeders that are out that during hunting season, I'm running in time feeders to try to give those folks a little better chance to shoot at something. And if a hog comes in, I'm not worried about it. That's fine. That's something else for them to shoot. But when I'm really worried about my supplemental feeding, like I am now, all of my feeders have panels around them where the deer can jump over and the hogs can't get in. That otherwise I'm feeding non-targets that I don't want to feed. Coons are bad enough, birds are bad enough. I can fix the hogs by putting those hog panels around there, and I make it big enough. I think each one of my enclosures have got seven of those 16-foot panels. So the deer jump over, I might have 10 or 12 deer in there on one of those big troughs, and the hogs will walk around outside a couple of times and they're gone. So I definitely don't want to feed hogs during the off season. During hunting season, it's a little different. It doesn't bother me as bad. And I'm running traps 365 down there.
Yeah, kind of on that same token, let's talk about the risks associated with supplemental feeding a little bit. You know, Nick mentioned pigs there, and whenever we put out troughs, I feel like the raccoons eat about 90% of our dang feed. I swear they get up in there and they're bad, the big ones too.
Yep, I usually have four or five little dog-proof traps around every one of my feeders. And when I go down on the weekends, it might not be, but a night or two that I can run them, but I do that year round. And it helps. It definitely helps knocking a few of those numbers down. I like the troughs a little bit better this time of year because it's keeping the feed off the ground, it's keeping it dry where you're not worried about so much molding and things like that. And with those exclosures like that, it does give the deer a chance to get in there and hopefully nothing, a coyote or nothing is going to be right in the edge of the bushes and sneak up there on them. They're in there and they're okay, because that's something you do have to worry about, is concentrating all your animals onto that one feeding spot, having it tucked back in a thicket where it can be a predator trap. So you do need to keep those things in mind. And I know a lot of people, it depends on what side of the fence you're on, is 50-50. Half the people hate feeding, half the people love feeding. They've all got their reasons, and that's fine. Everybody's got their right to an opinion. And I get this constantly in my position. Well, you know feeding's bad, so when you get chronic wasting disease, it's going to make it worse. Well, feeding is not bad if it's supplemented. If they're dependent on it, yeah, I'll give you, that's not good. That's not natural. It's putting animals at an unfair advantage. Feeding is not going to create a problem, in my opinion. Feeding can exacerbate a problem. It's just as simple as Joe's at home right now with 104 fever. All right. If the three of us were in a football stadium with Joe, the odds of us getting sick is slim to none. If we're in a broom closet, the odds of us getting sick is pretty good. It's the same thing with feeding. It's concentrating deer at high concentrations in one spot where if one of them's sick, you've got a greater opportunity for the rest of them to get sick. But you can say the same thing for a salt lick. You can say the same thing for a swamp chestnut when it's dropping, and every deer in the country is coming to that one spot. So just saying feeding's bad, that's kind of a cop out for me. If it's done right, it's no worse than a good oak that's producing. If it's done wrong, it's 10 times worse.
Yeah, that's very well said. You know, like a watering hole in a drought. I mean, they got to go drink.
That's right. Yep, you get out west. Some of my buddies in Arizona, New Mexico, and places like that, water holes are key to everything. So if one deer is sick and goes to a water hole, I managed property in Illinois. I think it was 2007. Had been managing a place for years. We had some really big deer. EHD came through. It was a drought. All those bucks were bachelored up. They were drinking out of the same little spot in the creek. It nuked the place. It was like 3 years before we were ever able to hunt that place
Wow.
because it knocked them out. That had nothing to do with feeding. It had nothing to do with anything other than they were concentrated on that little bitty water hole. And when one of them got it, the rest of them got it, and it absolutely destroyed that place.
Yep. Mother Nature.
So what you're saying basically is if that's something where somebody's concerned about it, and I know it's easiest to do all your eggs in one basket and have a big feeder there in the middle of your property, big food plot. But would you recommend if people are concerned about it, just trying to spread out, try to spread your deer herd, I guess, as much as possible. Make sure one that you've got the natural habitat so that they're eating all over your property. And then two, have more feed troughs instead of just having one big trough, have multiple sites or.
Well, I kind of look at it at two different things. One is management and one is hunting. Management wise, I want my place solid from one end to the other one, producing food, producing everything that those deer need, where they don't have to go off of my property. I'm giving them everything they need in as many places. Now, when it comes to hunting, I'm getting lazier in my old age. I don't want to have to work as hard as I used to. I want to concentrate on where I can see more. So it's two different things. They've got places to eat, bed, live over the whole property all year. But during hunting season, I've got a couple of bigger food plots that are centralized that I spend a little more time and care with that I want to be a little better. But so if I had 40 acres, I would want to fix my 40 acres up and I would want a big field in the middle of it if I'm the only person that's hunting it. And I want ways to get in where no matter what wind direction I've got, I can hunt that spot and I'm concentrating all the deer there during hunting season. Now, if it's me and three of my family members, I'm going to have little spots scattered around everywhere. So it's kind of what your objectives are on your place.
Very well said.
Mr. Sykes, I want to circle back to something we were talking about earlier. So I know you mentioned, that you were feeding soybeans and corn, and that you wanted to see a certain protein percentage in feed, right? That you didn't just want to be feeding deer candy. What are your thoughts when it comes to like trace minerals, like calcium and phosphorus and stuff like that? Do you believe that's something important, or are you more concerned with just making sure that they get those macronutrients?
I think it's important, but I don't know how much we can impact that just by pouring a 50-pound bag out. I had rather do soil samples on my food plots and make sure the pH is right on my food plots and make sure my fertilizer is being used properly where it's growing and getting the nutrients out of the ground to put in the plants. I had rather spend my money on fertilizing good native vegetation. But with that being said, I still keep salt out in 8 or 10 locations throughout the property. And sometimes I will put some dicalcium phosphate in there. It's not going to hurt anything. I don't know that you're going to turn a 110-inch Alabama deer into a 150 by putting out, 100 pounds of mineral on the ground, but there are certain times of the year when spring green up comes out, those deer hit those salt licks. They need it. They seek it out. Give it another month or two when those does are lactating, they hit the salt hard again then. So doing everything you can, and we'll use your 40 acres. Yeah, I would have a supplemental feed station on my 40 acres. I would do all of my management on my habitat, burning and thinning and weed control. I'd have my food plot with the right pH and fertilizer and the right plants in there. And yeah, I'd have at least one salt lick out with probably some dicalcium phosphate in it or some trace mineral salt. But I don't think for me, that's not where I'm going to focus my money and energy. If I've got extra, that's where I'll go. I think first and foremost is your habitat. You can do more with a match in a pine plantation than you can pouring it out of a bag or planting a food plot or putting out minerals. Thinning and burning, there's no substitute for it.
Yep, agreed. And that goes back to the definition of, like we talked about in the very beginning, supplemental feeding is supposed to be a supplement and not all they need. Do your habitat first, get your base right, and then anything that they need extra, you can give it to them.
And also herd management, trigger finger management is as important as anything because you've got a certain amount of food, cover, and water on your property. And that's all you can control, working with your neighbors to try to make that footprint as big as you can. But you can either grow more feed or you can take some deer off. And a lot of people have a hard time with that. Growing up in Choctaw County, when I was a kid, there wasn't any deer. I'm lucky I've got a 260 acre piece of land that my father's had, that his father had, that I started hunting with him when I was 6 years old, sitting in a food plot. He had a food plot back in the late 70s, and there probably wasn't another one for 5 miles. And if we hunted for 2 weeks and saw a deer, that was something. By the time I was in high school in the mid 80s, if I didn't see 40 deer, I was unhappy. Both of those were unrealistic. They were unhealthy populations. Now I can go sit on that same plot and I'll see 6 to 8, maybe a dozen. The deer are in better shape. The habitat's in better shape. So keeping your numbers where they need to be, you're going to lose one way or the other. You either got to have more feed or less deer. And it's easier to have good native habitat and get on your trigger finger and manage the right numbers than trying to pour it out of a bag.
And I would assume that that herd management goes back to the historical data that you're talking about as well. Kind of figure out, you gotta know what you have before you can figure out what you need.
You got to have a baseline to start with. And it's real easy. It'll take you 5 minutes. Kill a deer. Don't guess. Yeah, that deer weighs 118 pounds. No, put it on a set of scales, get you a clipboard, and just keep a little bit of data, and you'll know whether you're spending your money in the right places or not.
Awesome, awesome points, Director Sykes. We really appreciate you being on today. We can tell that you're passionate and knowledgeable about this topic. Thanks for sharing your wisdom with our listeners. I know you guys have some resources and a lot of things at your disposal over there. If people want to get involved and or want to learn more about this topic, where would you push them to?
Yeah, they just need to go to outdooralabama.com. Everything about our department is there. Nick was talking about SOA hunts. You can go to Outdoor Alabama and find out when it's time to register for an SOA hunt. If you've got a piece of property and you want to get it on the Deer Management Assistance Program, where we'll send one of our technical assistance biologists out, look at your property, help you set up a plan for it. And with that program, the way I do it on our place, if I want to shoot four does in a day and I've got five buddies down hunting, we can shoot all of our does in one weekend and get it over with. And it gives us as a state some real concrete data in specific parts of the state where we can really fine-tune and make sure that the state is headed in the right direction on our deer management. So I'd encourage more people to get on that program if they could.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Again, we appreciate you being on today. We enjoyed it. It was a great show. Thank you.
Thank you all for having me. It's fun to actually talk about stuff that I went to college and back when I could make people happy going to their property and tell them what to do to make better deer and more turkeys and all that. So this was fun to take off the politics and the bureaucracy and just talk about management. So thank you.
Yes, sir. Put your biologist hat on again for a while.
Absolutely.
All right, folks, we're going to be right back. Y'all take a minute and check out some of our sponsors. This week's show is brought to you by NCX. As a landowner, the more income I can generate from my land, the better I can take care of it. That's why I use NCX. NCX helps over 20,000 American landowners like you understand and maximize the value of every acre. Find new revenue streams for your land with programs like timber, carbon, wildlife habitat, solar energy, and more. Get started with a free account at ncx.com and discover the true value of your land. And also brought to you by Southern Seed and Feed. Do you want to provide better nutrients to your deer? If so, try Southern Buck Food Plot Blends. Your deer will love it. At Southern Seed and Feed, they specialize in making textured feed for horses, cattle, sheep, goats, hogs, chickens, small animals, and wildlife. Their products are proven irresistible, scientifically formulated to promote excellent herd health and hunter satisfaction. They supply products to various distributors throughout the South. So visit their website at southernseedfeed.com or call 662-726-2638 to find the dealer nearest you.
Nick, that was a cool show, man. I definitely learned a lot. It was good getting to know Mr. Chuck. What'd you pick up from today's show? Anything stick out to you?
Yeah, no, it was real good talking with him. I didn't know that his personal background was, kind of specifically in herd management. So that was good to know. I think he was a real good guest, really well qualified to speak on the subject. And I enjoyed, like I kind of alluded to, like I've always looked at supplemental feeding with a raised eyebrow because I think a lot of people don't do it like he was talking about. I think a lot of people is just baiting. But what he was saying, really, struck me. Saying that he would rather them get their nutrients from dirt than just pouring it out on the ground.
Yeah, and
I
starting
think
with habitat management first.
habitat first, and just like I've read a lot on human nutrition, and everybody will tell you, the latest whiz bang supplements. That's okay, but if you're not getting your five a day and your whole grains and your lean proteins, it's probably going to be hard to take a supplement and fix what ails you.
Yep, not an easy, no easy fix or, magic bullet, as they say.
Yeah, and definitely like what he was saying about, and what you were talking about, the point you raised about, having a baseline and doing the hard work, the boring work of doing the data collection and keeping track of it over time. I feel like that's something people neglect sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm super guilty. I planted all these beans. Where's the 150s at? Like, but it's
Right.
not that easy. Again, there's no magic bullet. You got to put in the work. I'll definitely gonna step up my documentation, I guess would be a good way to put it. Just start making a little log. This is how much, all the deer weighed this year, and see what you got, and see what you got versus, the next year and the next year. And then you can really figure out what they need and what you need to be putting. If they're not putting on any weight or getting bigger, or you can beef it up a little bit, add a little more
Yeah.
supplement, add a little more supplemental feeding.
Yeah, there we go. Need to get on that DMAP too.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Enjoyed it, man. That was a fun show.
Absolutely.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for us this week. Appreciate you joining us. We want to make it easy for you to listen. So here's a handy option for you. To get the podcast emailed to you each week, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. Again, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. You'll join our email list. And wherever you are listening to podcasts, go ahead, subscribe, rate, and review. Send us a written review. We'd love to hear from you. If you got a show topic that you are interested in and like to see us cover, just email us at pros@landhunting.com. That's going to do it for us. Y'all stay safe out there. We'll talk to you next time.